perfect proxy is far less than a democracy. It only deals with bottom line. It does not deal with nobody else's rights. It sells them out. So there is no protection in corporations. But as individual tribes with sovereignty, as a member of the human phylum, we do have human rights. And it is in this context that your right in Australia, your right in Rankin Inlet, and my right in Prudhoe Bay must not be destroyed. And it is this shared commonality that we are part of the greater human effort, and we have not chose to commit suicide. And why this is important, because Congress of the United States, with the aid of some Alaskan leadership, committed legislative infanticide, that it saw in its wisdom for people to cease to exist without their permission. And I believe since 1948, the UN Charter, the United States of America, had to have permission from the UN for Alaska to become a state. So Eskimo Indian sovereignty is far from extinction. And so I hope that we can go back to Congress and to create and define a policy that is constitutionally applicable uniformly across the American Constitution. Right now, the Alaska Natives and the Indians in the lower 48, they are denied legal representation. If the Secretary of Interior does not approve your attorney's contract, you may have a legal problem with the United States. If he doesn't have an approved contract, you can't spend tribal resources to pay the guy. And the authorization is dependent upon the Secretary of Interior. And this problem of not able to have independent counsel has diminished the value of a constitution, for the simple fact that they have created a structural injustice which cannot be redeemed by dollars alone. And so I feel that if you ask the rest of the villages, I believe that the direction of this commission should consider Alaska Native People Restoration Act, where these basic federal preemption law takes hold. And for those Alaska Natives that wish to abandon their tribal relations, I would like to refer to them to a federal statute where this is possible. The 1991 date is already here. More damaging to Alaska Natives was the Federal Lands Policy Management Act of 1976. What that did was it took statutory rights away from the Alaska Native people, meaning that they must have some Fifth Amendment rights if these rights are statutory, meaning that the core township of a village is a valid existing right, that it is not vacant, it is appropriated. And when State of Alaska, the Bureau of Land Management, and the Village Corporation stole this from the Native councils of these IRA communities, the Secretary of Interior, the Director of Bureau of Land Management, is susceptible to a legal mandamus for trespass. So to this day, I have informed the Bureau of Land Management, according to their land regulations per ANCSA, for the simple fact that they didn't fool me then during the process. Were they going to fool me after the legislation was completed, because I was the only guy that went through the process? And so the rights that the Alaska Native people have derived from the Fifth Amendment, and they must be protected. And it is this little string, if is Fifth Amendment unilaterally applicable to all Americans in United States? I have a court opinion that says no. And so even with that, I feel that the management, that the whaling management that the Eskimos have developed for the world is a worthy model of Aboriginal extraterritorial jurisdiction throughout the world on the species that we hunt on. And so instead of our carrying pasture being in the north, we also have a southern pasture. And we wish for the rest of the world to be equally concerned about the protection. And the Inuit Circumpolar Conference have declared a nuclear-free zone in the Arctic. We are not alone for the simple fact that that the Russian and the American administration have seen profitably for their own constituency to make more arms, thus making world peace more vulnerable. And we feel, even with that, that in the energy development, that we Native people have a genuine opportunity to utilize our nationalist forum to get into economic engagement, such as I'm going to propose to the Secretary of Interior that we amend the pipeline permit for American Indians along the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Corridor, receive contracting of the pump stations, so that foreign state enterprises such as Sohio, who owns 54% of Prudhoe Bay, takes his money away from Alaska, because Alaska Native people and the state legislature refuse to own the transportation system. Americans are losing $330 million a year in fees, which should have remained in Alaska. And we feel that we can utilize the President Reagan's mandate to work on government-to-government basis, and the greatest capital formation that is available to the Alaska Natives and the Canadian Indians and the Inuit is the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Corridor for the simple fact that there is a treaty, and in the treaty with Canada would enable us to have power contracts with our Canadian counterpart and making the Buy American Act meaningful. And everybody has talked about unemployment. Well, I want to remind Alaskans that this is a political year, and that pipeline that they have in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is Japanese pipe. So it's an un-American pipeline.
I thank you, Charlie. Daley Sambo of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference.
Well, I'll be speaking for myself. It's a hard statement to follow. I just wanted to make a very broad observation. I've had the benefit of listening to the entire overview hearings from the beginning of February 27th on up to this date. It's been an enlightening experience. Throughout the 3 weeks, there has been reference to sovereignty, independence, self-government, self-determination, self-sufficiency, full autonomy, self-control, nations within a nation, states within a state, government-to-government relations. I think that whatever terms we use and whatever approaches we use within our own respective countries, we're all working towards the same end. The approaches may be very subtle, they may be very passive, they may be very aggressive and extreme and radical, but they're all in an effort to the same end. The end being a security of a land base, security of the resources, self-government, self-control, all of those things. And I think that the bottom line is that we're all moving and making basic efforts to preserve ourselves as a race, to be kept from being wiped off the face of the earth. There are some basic underlying problems, at least that was noted last week in the second week of the overview hearings about the underlying problems here within the United States. The U.S. government on the federal level having plenary power, having unilateral power over Indian affairs, the affairs within Canada. I think that there's one area in which Canada seems to be ahead of the United States, and that is in addressing Aboriginal rights on a constitutional level and putting it within the framework of the Constitution. That needs to be done within the United States. It needs to be done on a national level throughout. But moreover, the work has to be done, as Shorty O'Neill has mentioned and Alfie Cascatello has mentioned, on an international basis. We need to lock arms internationally. I think that the most important aspect of all of these processes, whatever approach you choose to take within your own arenas, whatever arena is appropriate for you and wherever you come from, the most important aspect of all of these processes is to simply exercise and demonstrate those rights, exercise and demonstrate those powers. That's really the true essence of being sovereign or having self-control or being independent. Have self-governments, to exercise and demonstrate them, whether the U.S. government, the Canadian government, the Australian government recognizes it or not. Thank you.
Thank you, Daley. Doug Sanders, you started the discussion off on Tuesday, so we'll give you the last word, except for The chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was in touch by telephone this morning with Jose Carlos Morales, the president of the World Council of Indigenous Peoples. He asked that I convey to you and to everyone here his regrets that he was not able to be here this week and his best wishes for the success of the conference. I was struck by Don Mitchell's question before lunch, as I think many were. The question as to whether things like ANCSA should be understood simply in terms of a short-term transaction under pressure. ANCSA was necessary to get access to the Prudhoe Bay oil discoveries rapidly, and therefore there would be no political, legal, moral, or other kind of will to reopen or reconsider the questions that are involved. It seems to me that it is possible to reopen questions of settlements of indigenous claims. There are a few examples that can be cited easily. The Menominee Restoration would be the best known in the United States. Secondly, the terminationist aspects of the allotment policy under the Dawes Allotment Act in the United States was ended, legislatively reversed, by provisions in the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. In British Columbia, the issue of the cutoff lands has been successfully reopened. In both New Zealand and Japan, there was a reconsolidation of indigenous lands in the 1920s. Each of these examples are examples of the reopening of indigenous claims or settlements in contexts that were not legally necessary. There was no statement or admission by the nation state involved that the earlier matters being reopened or redone had been legally deficient the first time around. Therefore, other factors were dominant. I have tried to do a bit of an analysis of what I think the factors have been in a number of jurisdictions in which there have been land claim settlements and in some in which there have not. It's resulted in a 9-page paper. I had some copies made, but it appears that page 3 is missing. So you will get a full set of the paper. This is simply an attempt to work out a typology which would show the factors that have been important. And I would just like to suggest that in terms of these settlements, there's certainly more factors involved than the short-term goal of getting access to the Prudhoe Bay oil or the sites for the James Bay hydroelectric project. You yourself, Mr. Chairman, just before lunch commented that there were other examples in which an imminent project was not involved. So one could pose as a second factor a concern with long-term economic development, which is certainly very real in settlements like COPE and the CYI settlement. There is, thirdly, a concern with stability on the part of many of the governments. They recognize that they, in the what they have classified as hinterland areas in which there are large populations of indigenous peoples, that there has been a long range process of marginalization and economic dislocation in the areas, and the possibility of violence, of threats to the political stability of the region are real. That's a concern which is often not articulated by governments. They don't want to admit that that is a concern, but it's very frequently there. Fourthly, I'd suggest that sometimes in these settlements, there are elements of planning. In some ways, one can look at the James Bay and Northern Quebec agreements and characterize them not as land claim settlements at all, but as efforts at regional planning of social, political, and economic character for a region in which relatively little coherent planning had gone on before. I must say, looking at Alaska, I find it very difficult to characterize ANCSA in planning terms, but certainly there were certain kinds of elements of that. Fifthly, there are certain kinds of moral concerns. The nation states within which we live can be described at least as morally pretentious. They are concerned with image. They hold themselves out as being moralistic. Norway has gone to some efforts to establish a benevolent international image by making indigenous people part of their foreign aid program. This has given certain openings for Sami and others to point out the internal contradictions between what Norway says about Bolivia and what Norway says about Inner Finnmark. The Senate committee report from Australia of last fall lists as one of the interests of the government of Australia in some kind of compact with Aboriginal people. They make this statement: Australia's ability to speak on apartheid and human rights internationally is undercut by its treatment of Aboriginals. Australia was very concerned with getting the chairmanship of the Security Council a few years ago and was convinced that there was a high possibility of a third world veto stimulated by Aboriginal protests in Australia. And whenever Canada has been criticized internationally, it is on human rights questions, it has always been on questions of Inuit and Indian policy. In fact, I like to point out that we have been criticized by some of the most unsavory governments in the world. Canada has been criticized by Hitler, George Wallace, and South Africa on its Indian policy. If we are morally pretentious, as I think we are, we find that extremely uncomfortable. Oh, we now have page 3. Thank you, Don. And finally, and I've deliberately left it to the last of the list, not because of Shorty's comments about the role of lawyers, but because that's where I put it, and that is legality, that you do have formal contradictions within the systems which allow, at least in some countries, the courts to play some role in stimulating political movement. And that is, I think, the relationship that has occurred in Canada, the loss of the first major land rights case in Australia, a very serious loss technically, in terms of the judgment of the Australian court, has obviously not ended the questions of Aboriginal rights within Australia. In many ways, the reasoning of the court is almost irrelevant to the political struggles that have gone on since then and have not prevented some significant innovations since that time. And so I suggest that the range of factors that are involved in these questions are not the simple short-run issue which Don Mitchell posed in his question before lunch. It isn't that simple. Things can't be reduced quite that dramatically. If they could be, I don't think any of us would be here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug, for those thoughtful remarks. Well, let me just say a word or two in closing this 3 weeks of overview roundtable discussions by thanking you all for your attendance, thanking the media for their attendance, and thanking the public for their attendance. And I would like once again to thank the Humanities Forum of Alaska for sponsoring the overview roundtable discussions. Ron Scollin, the chairman, Andrea Helms, who has been attending this session for the Forum Statewide Committee, and Gary Holthaus, executive director. I'd like to thank Jim Sykes and Tim Buckley for their audio recording, and the University of Alaska Instructional Telecommunication Services, the North Pacific Rim Incorporated, the North Slope Borough, and Alaska Independent Public Television for their videotaping of the overview. I would like to announce as well that the charter flight to Whitehorse and Yellowknife is leaving at 6 a.m. and be at the door of the Westward Hilton at 5:30 a.m. Now that's a.m. And the only other thing thing I want to say to all of you is that this
order,
commission...
Yes? Point of order. Being the native representative at this table and having had the order brought down by my colleague here, I'm going to amend that to 7 a.m.
All right. 7 a.m., but I guess that means be at the door of the Westward Hilton at 6:30 a.m. Could I just refer to Mike Albert's testimony? I think Shorty was right in saying that all of us were struck by what Mike Albert said this morning. Charlie Edwardson said, ask the villages. Well, that's what this commission is about. We've had 3 weeks of talking here in Anchorage, and it's been good talk, good discussion. I've gained an awful lot from it, and I hope each of you has gained a lot from it also. But this commission will now spend the rest of the year holding meetings in the villages of Alaska. There are 200 villages. We're going to try, indeed we are going to go to villages in every region, and we are going to give everybody at the villages that we visit an opportunity to speak on all of the questions that we've been concerned about here these past 3 weeks. We hope that in the fall we will have an opportunity of holding additional roundtable discussions on some issues specific to Alaskan concerns. And then when the village meetings are completed, as I expect they will be early in 1985, we will be writing a report that will be made public in the summer of 1985 and will, I hope, give to Alaska Natives the means of planning their future for themselves, of charting new directions for themselves. I hope that report will as well be of use to Aboriginal people in other countries and, if I may say so, perhaps to their governments also. The meetings here have been fascinating in a way. We saw how ANCSA was developed back in the early 70s. We saw how it's unfolded. We saw how the Inuit and the Cree of James Bay and Northern Quebec looked at ANCSA, adopted some features, rejected others. Then the Inuvialuit of the Western Arctic looked at James Bay and Northern Quebec, incorporated some features of that settlement in their own agreement. And then we heard yesterday how the Yukon Indian people had developed their own agreement just this year and how they had looked to other agreements and come up with their own ideas. I think it is important to note that all of these experiences have now been brought back here to Alaska, and now that Alaska Natives are reviewing their land claims legislation, it is appropriate that Alaska Natives should gain insights from those who learned from their experience over the past 12 years. I'm especially grateful that we had representatives here from the Aboriginal people of Australia. I think we all were struck by how far they had gone, how much they had achieved since 1967. It is a remarkable story, and while they are by no means satisfied with the progress made, it did impress me how much they had achieved in so short a time. We expressed our gratitude to Dr. Robert Peterson of Greenland for attending this morning, and I have already expressed, as I wish to do again, my appreciation to Alf Isaac Keskitalo for attending to represent the people of Sami Land. I want to thank those who wrote papers for the overview, Walter Parker, who's been with us throughout, Douglas Sanders, who's been with us this week, Ann Phenop Reardon, who was here for the first week, and Joe Jorgensen, who came for the second week. I hope that we will all be seeing each other again. I wish you all a safe journey to your indigenous homelands, and I hope that we will see each other again soon. So I declare the meeting adjourned.
just going to look after you. Okay, just sign that. I can. That's to Larry, and we'll look after that. These are your copies. This is a letter that came for you today. I opened it just to see what it was. It looks like something you should take home.
Okay, thanks. Oh, this is Doug's, eh? Good.
Speaking of that, Dora will look after getting it.